Australia. Stop it now. R1. R2. R3. Take.
Like their irreplaceable former broadcaster, Harry Carey, the Chicago Cubs have a unique history, in part because of their loyal fan base, in part because of their distinctive and enduring home ballpark, but also in part to a seemingly endless hope for a World Series championship, no matter how hopeless the team is. To date, it's been nearly 107 years since the Chicago Cubs won it all. However, those who dare to believe the plotline of the movie Back to the Future 2 will note that the film, released in 1989 and set in our present year, depicts the Cubs getting that long-awaited ring in 2015. We're not ready to fully believe that life will imitate art, even with the present optimism that will engulf Wrigley Field come opening day. But it is just one example of how the Chicago Cubs have influenced many aspects of our history and our culture. This is described in great detail, 77 chapters to be exact, by author Scott Rowan throughout his book, The Cubs Quotient, which was released in March 2014 and can be purchased on Amazon, among other sellers. I began by asking this Maryland native how he became a supporter for the team on the Windy City's north side.
Yeah, I was a Maryland native, so I grew up as an Orioles fan, and the Orioles are still my American League team. I actually moved to Chicago back in 99, so it's been 15, almost 16 years now, and I fell in love back in 98. I was there for a week vacation and nearly caught one of Sammy Sosa's home runs, and spilled my beer all over myself while I was at Wrigley Field, made a mess of myself, and I couldn't have had a better time. Fell in love with it. You know, I was in my late 20s at the time, but I felt like I was a 10-year-old kid, you know, and so, the Cubs are my National League team, but the O's are always going to be my AL team.
Okay, so one element of your book, The Cubs Quotient, which you won't find in your average book, is an invention of yours called Geoverse. Could you tell us what it is and how it enhances the reader's experience?
Yeah, Geoverse is something that we created to try and take a book beyond just reading it. So in this case, what it does is it uses a GPS. It also uses video and audio so that you come across different sections in the book. And for example, you're reading about Al Capone and the Cubs quotient, and you come across a section on it. And when you get to the Valentine's Day Massacre, you click, if you're reading the e-book, you just click on it, and on your device, if you have the GPS put on the, if it's on a device that has GPS on it, it's going to open up the page that has all the information and gives you personalized directions via Google Maps, the exact location where this happens. So you can use it as a tour guide, you know, if you're a baseball fan. Not just a Cubs fan, but a baseball fan. I mean, we've got places in Cincinnati and Indiana and Illinois and across the country where, you know, if you want to just take a baseball tour and you're not sure how close you are to something, you can use Geoverse. And it'll tell you, you know, where the next major marker is. You might be 10 feet from it, or you might be a few hours away.
As you have displayed in this book, the Cubs have impacted a lot of moments in history and vice versa. Impact not just in baseball itself, but also race, politics, religion, and so on. Do you know of other baseball teams, maybe the Yankees or Red Sox or Dodgers, that have a similar impact on society like the Cubs do?
Well, they do. I mean, when you go back, the reason why the Cubs have got such an impact is because they were there first with the National League starting, with William Hulbert back in the 1870s. The Yankees and the Red Sox, and many people think that they would have you know, and of course, even the Orioles to a certain extent, a history that would be impactful. But the reality is that those teams didn't come along until after 1900, really. And by then, the Cubs already had baseball's first dynasty begin, last for 10 years, and completely die off before the Yankees or Red Sox ever even played their first game. But the Dodgers, if you really want to look for a team, of course the Yankees and the Red Sox, I do have books coming out, we're working on them right now, so we're going to have books on the Yankees and the Red Sox, but the one team that really has impressed me the most has been the Dodgers, whether you want to call them the Brooklyn Dodgers or the L.A. Dodgers. But the Dodgers, really, more than any pro organization, as much as the Cubs have really altered, you know, everything from commerce to politics, they really have been very impactful.
So there are 77 chapters, nearly 200 stories. Some are well-known to Cubs fans and baseball fans alike, but there are some that are new to me and probably would be new to just about anyone reading. I wanted to touch on a few of them with you. The first set of stories I wanted to discuss would revolve around the 1932 season, which was a crazy year from beginning to end. It was one that concluded with a World Series loss to the Yankees, in which there was the alleged called shot by Babe Ruth. But prior to that, the team dealt with a lifetime's worth of drama.
Yeah, the 32 season easily will go down as one of the strangest ever, and in many ways, from particularly the Cubs' point of view, you know, there was a what would be euphemistically called a showgirl, but really a call girl, a prostitute, and a con man who helped change the entire complexity of the season. As many people may remember, you know, that was Violet Valley was the young woman's name. And she had a love affair with one of the players on the team. And she went a little crazy, and she shot him. And but what while many people know about that, what really was surprising to me was to find out that there was a con man in Chicago who was well known, and he learned about the situation between Violet Valley and Billy Gerges, Billy Gerges being the player, and she had kept some of their love letters and their correspondence. And so this guy, Lucius Barnett, the con man in Chicago that was well known to the police in Chicago, he began blackmailing the Chicago Cubs. And it created quite a turmoil for the team, and they were having a disruption. And so that's, you know, because of the shooting, they had to bring a Mark Keening from the Yankees. They made a trade, but the Cubs really treated Keening horribly because he was only there for part of the season. He was a rental player, and the Cubs had a championship team. Mm-hmm. And the Yankees were really pissed off about the way that their former teammate was treated. And the teammate wouldn't have been there had this call girl not shot, you know, the Cubs player, had not shot Gerges. And then everything went totally crazy when the con man got involved because he was trying to blackmail them for $50,000. And, I mean, this is at a time when guys are only making $1,000 for a season.
That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. It would be millions of dollars today. And so the FBI had to get involved. It became the FBI technically wasn't formally formed at that time, but the government had to get involved in the investigation. And it was completely hushed up. I didn't even know anything about it until I was really digging through the Violet Valley story and suddenly learned about this bad guy, this really bad dude, Lucius Barnett. He had a great name, Lucius, and he just was, by all accounts, he passed himself off as a preacher, apparently, and that's what he claimed. But he claimed he met Violet at church.
So,
that's how the story goes. But let's be honest, it makes for a good cover and a good story. But I don't think anyone's believing that.
Now, Babe Ruth's called shot, which I mentioned earlier, has proven over time to really be a myth. I think we all want to believe this tale for the sake of baseball folklore, but as you point out, history has stated otherwise.
Yeah, it unfortunately is a myth. I mean, it is a great story, but even from Babe Ruth's mouth himself years later, he said really the obvious thing, Look, it isn't true. There was no way I'd do it. The biggest reason is because the guy he was going up against, Charlie Root, was the pitcher. Mm-hmm. And Charlie Root's nickname was Chinsky. And Chinsky, and it wasn't because he was a cheapskate. It was because he was a headhunter. And if he had no problem brushing you right upside the chin with the ball, and that's how he got his nickname. And so as Babe Ruth said, if there was anybody to not antagonize out there, it would be, Chinsky. It would be Charlie Root, who was, you know, sort of like Roger Clemens. Remember when Roger Clemens threw the bat at Piazza and just was being real petulant? That's the kind of guy that Root was. And so Ruth said, you know, no, there was no truth to it. But it was just too good a story to pass up. And obviously Ruth had an incredible career in large part because of such a myth.
I'll never forget, it was a tough series. Both clubs riding each other, doing everything to get each other's goat. Well, after this one particular time when I went to bat, Charlie Root was pitching. And the first pitch ball was a call strike. Well, I thought it was outside and didn't like it very much. So the boys that were there would give me this, on ya. Well, the second pitch ball was another call strike. Well, I didn't like that one either, so I let it go by. Well, I stepped out of the box, and by that time they were over there going crazy. Well, I looked out at center field and I tore it. I said, I'm going to hit the next pitch ball right past the flagpole. Well, the good Lord must have been with me.
I want to rewind a couple decades and switch topics to politics. There have always been contentious debates and races dating back to the birth of this country and beyond, but the 1912 election and the battle between Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft created a divisive political climate that we continue to see today. What made them such adversaries, and how did that tie into the Cubs?
We go in the way back machine to Teddy Roosevelt at the turn of the century was the reason why he's on Mount Rushmore in large part is because of the conservation acts that he put forth. He was the president who realized that places like Yellowstone National Park, Yosemite National Park, even Shenandoah region, you know, should be made into national parks. Such a thing didn't even exist in the world. So he was, that was one of the reasons why he's on Mount Rushmore. He was very popular because of it. And at the end of his two terms, there was actually discussions of him running a third term, but of course he didn't because, you know, the Constitution doesn't allow for that. So he really could handpick his successor, who was William Howard Taft. And so Teddy Roosevelt felt that he really made William Howard Taft. But William Howard Taft didn't see it that way. He saw himself as his own man. And his political advisor was Charles Taft, his older brother. Mm-hmm. Charles Taft was known to Cubs fan as the owner of the Chicago Cubs. The Taft family had been huge in the baseball for their entire lives. Both men played at Yale. And so Charles Taft was a kingmaker in every sense of the word. He owned what later became the Cincinnati Post. So he was a newspaper man, and he owned the Chicago Cubs. And so as William Howard Taft ran for president, he was the first to really use baseball to show how much of an everyday guy he was. Mm-hmm. And Teddy Roosevelt hated it, told him it was a stupid idea. He called baseball a mollycoddle sport, and mollycoddle is a big fancy word for sissy. And so he thought all baseball players were sissies. He thought that football was a manly sport, and he liked hunting. He liked killing things, you know. So that was sort of the bad part of Teddy Roosevelt. But when finally William Howard Taft got into office, the very first letter he wrote once he hit the Oval Office was to Teddy Roosevelt. And in his first two sentences as president, he said, "Thank you for your help. I couldn't have done it without you and Charles Taft, without my brother Charles." And that incensed Teddy Roosevelt, because he would refuse to be compared to such a sissy as a baseball person. And it sounds ridiculous. You know, it sounds incredibly ridiculous. And that is exactly what William Howard Taft said. He turned to his aide, Archibald Butts, and said, "You've got to be kidding. There's no way this is really the basis of it." And, of course, there were other things. The Conservation Acts that Teddy Roosevelt had put forth, William Howard's had reversed, but the thing that stuck in Teddy Roosevelt's craw the most was being compared to a baseball guy. Mm-hmm. And he was assured by his friend, yeah, that baseball comparison infuriated Roosevelt.
I'm wondering, and I don't know if the people who run the Nationals know this, but maybe that's why Teddy Roosevelt didn't win any of those president's races back before 2012. I don't know. Yeah, another piece that ties to the Cubs, and something I was totally unaware of, you know, everyone assumes the first African-American player in professional baseball, Jackie Robinson, 1947. However, 63 years earlier, there was one who played against the Cubs franchise, and Cap Anson, who, as you put it, would be a first ballot inductee in the Racist Hall of Fame. Talk about that story and how that the Cubs franchise played a part in that.
That was one of the more interesting things, because like most other people, I always thought that Jackie Robinson was the first black player, the first African-American player, but if you pay attention, when Major League Baseball refers to Jackie Robinson, they never actually say that. What they'll say is, he broke the color barrier. And what they leave off to the second half of the sentence is, you know, the color barrier that we, Major League Baseball, erected. They're not going to say that because it embarrasses themselves. But when you go all the way back to the 1880s, actually, we're going all the way back to 1883, and Moses Fleetwood Walker was the first African-American Major League player, and his younger brother, Welde Walker, was the second. They both played on the same team in the same season back in 1883. The short story of it was that they were playing for the Columbus team, and after the Tri-Patriot Pact in 1883, that realigned what was considered to be Major League Baseball, because in the early years, organized baseball was constantly having leagues appear and disappear from season to season, and so being able to keep consistent, consistent teams and have the leagues exist on a predictable year after year basis, they had to enter this Tri-Patriot Pact, and that was between the National League, the Northwestern League, and the American Association. And what came out of that was the Toledo team in Ohio became a major league, and their catcher was Moses Fleetwood Walker, and so he was the first African American player. But the problem was, the Cubs were then the White Stockings, but the Cubs were the number one team. They were the most dominant. They were in the middle of the very first dynasty in pro baseball, so they dominated the sport. And when the Cubs went to play the Toledo team with Moses Walker on it, they refused to take the field, and they wouldn't take the field. It actually goes, goes back to 1883. They played again. They tried to play again. They did play the game in 1883. The Cubs did so under complete protest. But I have to admit that the person that I found the most respectable was Toledo manager Charlie Morton, because he initially saw that there was going to be a problem having a black player on the field. Cap Anson and the White Stockings, the Cubs, were really showing the total racist feelings of the day. We are talking less than 20 years since the Civil War. So the Civil War just ended years earlier. Racism was rampant. I mean, it wasn't something that the Cubs were the only ones guilty of. It really was the tenor of the day. But boy, Cap Anson didn't hide it. I mean, he's really embarrassing in the way he acted. Mm-hmm. But they played that game. The second year they were supposed to play in 1884, and they couldn't come to terms because the Cubs insisted that no black players take the field. And Toledo, to their defense, said, screw you, we're not going to play. And they actually had a couple of more battles over the years in 1887 and 1888. Fleetwood Walker was playing for other teams that had to play the Cubs, and unfortunately, every single time, they went through this all over again. And when you get to the end of the day, Fleetwood Walker had an incredible career. He was a complete historic figure that is forgotten. I mean, he doesn't even get footnotes. Nobody remembers him. It's not that Jackie Robinson did is any less. What he did was incredibly heroic, but imagine having to do it 60 years earlier when there are still survivors of the Civil War in the stands saying they're going to kill you after the game. I just think that what Fleetwood went through, what Moses went through, was at least as difficult as Jackie Robinson, if not worse.
Yeah, very underappreciated. Now, one well-renowned figure in Chicago, Al Capone, as you talked about earlier, you can expect he had contact with a lot of Cubs players and personnel, and he helped protect them as well. One of them he protected, one of the players he protected was Hack Wilson during his record-setting RBI season. What was their relationship like, and how did Al Capone help out Hack Wilson?
You know, it's funny because Al Capone really was a big Cubs fan. A lot of people associate him with the South Side, South Side where the White Sox currently are. But he said that, you know, he really liked the North Side. It had the more upside in the future. He thought that's where partying would be. That would be the center of social life. And he's proven to be more right than wrong on that. But, you know, back in the 30s, one of the biggest crimes that was happening, one of the more popular crimes, was kidnapping. Kidnapping was a real big deal back then. As many people remember, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, that was back at this time. And it was so serious, even Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner of baseball, sat down and instructed his children on exactly what to do if and when they get kidnapped. Everyone took that very seriously. And being a fan of the Cubs, Al Capone could see that Hack Wilson was having an incredible season in 1930. And so that Hack didn't have to worry about his family being kidnapped or somebody being hurt and harmed, Al Capone took one of his personal bodyguards, a guy named T-Bone, and had him protect Hack Wilson's family, and nothing happened to Hack Wilson's family. There are no stories of any threats of any kind, which is pretty astonishing considering that his popularity went through the roof. And one of the things that prompted the cover, you know, the protection of Al Capone, protection, was the fact that right as the season was starting, one of Hack Wilson's neighbors was murdered. He apparently had a disagreement with somebody in the gangs. It was completely gang-related. He wasn't an innocent victim. But it just goes to show that he was having people getting murdered within feet of his front door. So the guys who were doing the killing, they weren't afraid of anything. It wasn't like they said, well, we can't go in that neighborhood. No, they had no problem. They were killing them right in the same apartment building that Hack Wilson lived in.
So many of these 200 stories that you described in the book are either, you know, kind of obscure, or they are like the Al Capone story, or the Fleetwood Walker story are very outdated, but they're from way back. So what? Yeah, they're very back, way back in history. So what were the best sources for your research? I mean, was it interviews? Was it, you know, libraries, databases? I mean, I'm sure being in Chicago helped plenty, but what were the best sources for your research?
I poured over hundreds of books for this. I mean, like, just piecing together all the Al Capone elements required, you know, dozens of books. And to be honest with you, I reached out to the Capone family directly, and so that was really fantastic. I actually had a good time dealing with the Capone relatives, one of the older relatives, who actually confirmed for me a few things that when I pieced stories together, was able to confirm directly from them that, for example, there really was a connection between John Dillinger and Al Capone that had long been suspected, and I was able to get the Capone family to confirm that. But, you know, going back and pouring through old newspapers was the most important thing, because suddenly you could easily see the dots. When things are 50 and 100 years later, it's a lot easier for us to connect dots in history and see how one person was connected to, you know, this situation. You know, a good example is the Teapot Dome scandal. The Teapot Dome scandal centered on Harry Sinclair. Harry Sinclair, by all accounts, is one of the worst human beings who ever lived, an arrogant jerk who blatantly broke the law. And the Teapot Dome scandal was him purchasing oil fields that were owned by the government and putting the money in his pocket. He was also an owner of the Chicago Cubs. And when the discovery was made about this huge scandal, Calvin Coolidge didn't know what to do about it, so he turned to one person to say, what do I do about this? That person said, do absolutely nothing, and helped cover it up. That one person that he asked was William Howard Taft, whose family sold business and were partners with Harry Sinclair.
Now, the underlying element that lingers over the Cubs, and what adds kind of a little bit of additional intrigue to most of these stories, is, you know, just the fact of having not won a World Series since 1908. There has to be plenty of excitement for next year and the years to come, with the additions of Joe Maddon, John Lester, to go along with the young talent in place. Now, I'm fully aware that a Cubs championship would be the greatest moment in Chicago sports history, probably Chicago history, by a long leap, by leaps and bounds. And it would be a tremendous moment for baseball in general, just as it was for the Red Sox when they won in 2004 and then would subsequently do it again two more times. But I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate, if you will, for us on the outside who aren't Cubs fans, who are just, you know, witnessing it from beyond. Do you think some of the luster of their kind of their lovable loser personality would be worn off by a championship, just like it has for the Red Sox? I mean, the Red Sox kind of had this, you know, cursed element, and then when they won the championship and then they would win again, it's kind of gone away, and it's kind of legend now. You think that might happen? This might be the same thing for the Cubs?
It would be a wonderful problem to have to deal with, I think. You know, I think that there is something to be said for that, that's for sure. But I do think that the bigger story that people would focus on would be, if you stick to it long enough, anything can happen. Even if it takes you more than 100 years, if it takes you multiple generations, you can find, or as I say to people in the office, I say, look, going to the moon is no big deal. It's just checking off everything on your list of things to do. Now, there's 50,000 things on that list of things to do, but if you do all 50,000 and you do them correctly, you'll be walking on the moon just like Neil Armstrong was. But, you know, it is amazing. Like, when the Blackhawks, you know, won the Stanley Cups, you know, especially the past one, you know, because I was living right next to Wrigley Field up until a few weeks ago, and the amount of humanity that just poured out onto the streets immediately after it was really a lot of fun. But if the Cubs were to pull it off, I think we would feel the tilt of the earth alter just one degree.
Man, Cubs win! Cubs win!